Fanning, weekends on 2FM.
Just before Christmas, a story emerged that Eric Clapton was suing a German woman for copyright infringement, accusing her of selling a bootleg CD of one of his live shows from the 1980s. The woman said she wasn't aware that it was a bootleg CD as it belonged to her late husband. The bit that really got me about all this was that it was one CD. She wasn't selling loads of copies of it. It was just one. Anyway, a German court ordered the woman to pay €4,000 fine. Now, it's since emerged that Eric Clapton and his team are not pursuing the fine, saying that individuals like her are not the target, but rather the bootleg industry in Germany. Copyright infringement, that's what I want to talk about now. It's always been a thorny issue when it comes to music. Well, journalist Brian Boyd knows a thing or two about this, having seen countless examples down through the years, and he's with us now. Brian, good man yourself. Thanks a million for being with us again. Eric Clapton, he got pretty bad press in this case, and he gets bad press a lot and really, really invites it. But was it fair?
Was it fair of Clapton to go after the nice little lady in Germany? No, of course it wasn't fair, Dan, for God's sake. And also, I mean, what you mentioned there, I mean, he also threatened her. He said that the nice old lady whose husband had died, and she put up on eBay an Eric Clapton album, which was turned out to be a bootleg, therefore it was unauthorised. Eric Clapton's lawyers also said that if she decided to try and put it back up on eBay again, she would be looking at a fine of $280,000 and 6 months in prison. Mm. Now, because of the publicity of the case, he sort of backed down and stuff. But Eric Clapton, I mean, where do we start with Eric?
She should sell it as a kind of an NFT. It's the only one. Like, she should make a fortune, but don't put it up on eBay.
Well, this is the whole thing. She can't do that because of its bootleg status. The copyright belongs to Eric Clapton. But Eric Clapton, we have to realise, I mean, this is the man who... I'm going to be using very strong language here, but this is what he said at a concert in 1975. Get the foreigners out, get the wogs out, get the coons out, keep Britain white.
Yeah.
The black wogs and coons and Arabs and effing Jamaicans don't belong here. We don't want them here. We need to make clear to them England is for white people. Get the effing wogs out. Now, he has since said, now Eric Clapton, as you mentioned, he sort of apologised to the sweet old lady in Germany and said, oh, it was the lawyer's man, it wasn't me. It was Eric Clapton. Eric Clapton's lawyers cannot act unless he instructs them to. And similar to this hateful racist speech he gave in 1975, he has said, oh, well, you know, I was an alcoholic and a drug addict. This is patent. This is patent lies. As recently as 3 years ago, Eric Clapton was referring to Enoch Powell, whose speech he referenced from stage that night, who Enoch Powell was a far right-wing racist English politician. As recently as 3 years ago, Eric Clapton was referring to him as the greatest prime minister we never had. So we have to really...
And also, we have to
call it straight.
I think
Clapton,
he said, for his next concerts, anybody who has a vaccination is not allowed in. Something along those lines.
Well, anti-vaccination and far-right conspiracy theories go hand in hand, but that's another story.
Mm. Okay, is it an unusual situation where a member of the public is sued for copyright infringement?
It used to happen quite a lot. Do you remember when CDs first came out? We were allowed to bring the CD home and play it on ye olde CD player. But if we put it into our computer, it wouldn't play for copyright reasons. Now, when this whole Wild West frontier opened up about music being digitized, there was cases of you could go on your computer and you could, there was a place called Napster, which was an illegal site where you could just download every single song you wanted. And there were cases in the early days of music going digital where you would hear about a grandmother in Newark, New Jersey, being sued for $5 million because she downloaded a bunch of gangster rap songs. And all of this. And the publicity afforded to the record companies, they were going, why are you going after a grandmother in New Jersey? And why are you taking a 15-year-old boy in Idaho to court because they went in their computer and they went, oh, look, there's free music, I'm going to download it. And as a result of all that, they stopped doing it. And then they tightened up the rules and now music is all clean and it's all copyright affiliated. So you go on to iTunes, you go on to wherever, Spotify, and the copyrights have been cleared. So we've got over that obstacle. But it's still a very, very big issue, copyright. And it has, I mean, just looking at some of the
songs. When you say still a very big issue, I mean, are bands, musicians, do you think cracking down a little bit more when it comes to protecting copyright?
Absolutely, they are. Yeah, absolutely. It's it really is the whole. There's departments now. Record companies have, and you hear this anecdotally, record companies have whole floors full of IT geeks who are listening to current hits, and they're going, "Is that sample all cleared? Yeah. Or does that bridge or does that melody sound like an R&B song from 1964? Because if it does, we can go to court, demand 50% of the royalties. And 50% of the royalties of a hit song is a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, like, obviously, like, there's so many examples of late, not least Radiohead twice. Would you think of Lana Del Rey and the Get Free song? It is kind of creep, all right, no question about it. But then again, they stole The Air That I Breathe for that same song from the Hollies, and there's no question.
It all goes back to something. I mean, the most brazen example was probably Ice Ice Baby, which was basically Queen and David Bowie's Under Pressure. And Vanilla Ice just fronted out and said, no, it's different, and the court went, No, it's the exact same basis.
Do you remember the Pharrell Williams one? Like, it wasn't a plagiarism of lyrics or phrases or anything. It was just, you know, aping the style and the feel of that track, Got to Give It Up. That's a different thing. That's another kind of worms.
Well, that was actually more Robin Thicke. And that was a very interesting case because when they were talking about that song, they were saying the Marvin Gaye estate heard that song and they sued. And basically, they weren't suing, saying that, hold on, the notes are similar, so they've plagiarized the notes. They said that they've taken the feel and the sound of Marvin's Got to Give It Up song. The judge found in their favor, and Robin Thicke had to pay over
$5 million. Yeah, so in other words, you can copyright a musical style.
Copyright a musical mood.
Right, okay.
But to be fair, that song we're talking about, Blurred Lines, which is a disgraceful pro-rape song also, it's a since emerged. I don't think any DJs play that song anymore because the lyrics are they're incredibly insensitive and incredibly callous towards women. But that was an interesting case because a number of musicians, quite high-ranking musicians, Tears for Fears, Earth, Wind and Fire, The Black Crowes, Fall Out Boy, they all wrote to the judge. They took the time to write to the judge and said, hold on a second, if you find that Blurred Lines copied the mood and feel of a Marvin Gaye song from 30 years previous, that would be the end of us as musicians.
Exactly.
Now, the judge ignored them. But this is the whole point, Dave, that no song is truly original. I mean, if you look at like this famous case, It Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana, I could tell you five songs before had the exact same riff, but the riff was done differently, maybe in a different key, maybe on a Stratocaster as opposed to a Fender.
I mean, obviously we could go down the route which we've mentioned before, like in terms of The Verve and Bittersweet Symphony, which was a 4-second string sample of an orchestral piece that Andrew Luke Oldham had made in 66 of making an orchestral bit of the Stones albums. But the whole thing about that is just like, hold on a second now, like, what did the Stones steal exactly from every black musician from the 40s and 50s, etc.? Like, we could go down the Clapton case is a bit of an unusual one in music because we're more used to talking about copyright in the case of songs. In other words, accusations that one song sounds suspiciously like another. Let's forget the copywriting musical style as such, but the actual, you know, are we talking, are there a certain amount of notes that says, right, that's it, you've crossed the line, money?
There are. It's quite hard to pin down because you have, I was just watching that thing about George Harrison and he was talking about the court case he had. Now, George Harrison had the most, this is one of the most famous copyright infringement cases in music history. George Harrison was the first Beatle in 1970 to have a solo number one with My Sweet Lord. Yeah. Number one around the world, sold millions and millions. People listening to the song got on to the songwriter of a song called He's So Fine, which was released by the Chiffons in 1962, and said, guys, I was listening to the radio and I heard this George Harrison song and it sounds exactly like the song you wrote for the Chiffons in 1962. So it went to court and they brought in these musicologists and they also brought in George Harrison with his acoustic guitar and said, well, George, show us how you wrote the song so we can see if you copied this. Now, as George Harrison remembers it in the court case, now, he lost the court case because My Sweet Lord is, in fact, the same song.
It is.
He's So Fine. It was unconscious. It was simply what I was saying earlier, that melodies, riffs, hooks enter into some sort of cultural consciousness. And it wasn't like George Harrison was flicking through his record collection and found the Chiffon song and said, I'm going to rip that off and make millions of pounds. A, he didn't need to, and B, he wouldn't. But unconsciously, when he wrote My Sweet Lord, he
echoed. I can tell you what, I'm going to give you both. Here's My Sweet Lord, first of all.
My sweet Lord. My Lord.
Okay, My Sweet Lord from the end of the 60s, early 70s, and then way back before that, here's the Chiffons, but He's So Fine.
He's so fine.
I'm just thinking, the funny thing about all that is that if George had sung My Sweet Lord, Doolang, Doolang, he'd have been completely scuppered. OK, let's take a look at Men at Work, Land Down Under. Give me that example.
Just to quickly go back to that, Dave, because it was an interesting point you raised about the amount of notes used. So basically what they were saying in that court case was there's three notes which correspond to My Sweet Lord and three notes which correspond to He's So Fine. But the musicologists in that court case identified 25 more songs that used those same three notes in the exact same manner. So this is the point. It wasn't just.
Do you mean the defense for George, kind of?
Yes. Unfortunately, it didn't work. But the point they were making was, look, when you said notes, this is very interesting because it is to do with notes, and they said that the three notes are key to this melody. Yeah. And they are the key of the Chiffon song and the key of the George Harrison song. But 25 other songs also use those three notes.
Well, I mean, like when you think about with the Verve and that and Bittersweet Symphony, etc., they did take a kind of an average arrangement or something and they turned it into a special one, is what a lot of people were saying at the time. But I mean, they lost out at first.
The Verve story is very interesting because it's merely the intro to the song.
Mm. Yeah,
I
exactly.
think it's what? It's 10, 15 seconds. Then it's a completely original Richard Ashcroft composition, so there's no doubt about that.
Do you know, when you tip your hat to somebody, are you sampling them or are you kind of acknowledging them? Or are you just...
Both, and it could be unconscious. But under the law, and this is where the whole legal thing comes in, because the Verve released that song and they hadn't cleared it for the intro they had to pay over 100% of royalties of a song they wrote.
Do you remember what you call him, Chris Martin from Coldplay? They got in touch with Kraftwerk and said, can we steal that whole motif that runs through our song and your song? They said, well, the fact that you rang us, you can. And then and they were allowed to use it.
Yeah, I mean, those are the cases which you don't really hear about because they're settled with instant friendship and with a handshake. But we're talking about how important this is. Copyright can kill people. And you mentioned the Men at Work song, Down Under.
Yeah, tell me about
and
that.
And that actually is a hit song which is responsible for killing two people, according to the person who wrote it, due to the copyright case. What happened here, just briefly, is everyone knows the song. It's Land Down Under.
Yeah.
It went to number one in most every country in the world. This is back in 1981, by the way. It made multi-millions for the band, and it still is seen as the unofficial Australian national anthem. 26 years after it was released, and this is bizarre, there was an Australian TV quiz show called Spicks and Specks. And the quizmaster asked a contestant the following question. What children's song is contained in the hit single Down Under? And the contestant answered, Kookaburra. Kookaburra is an old Australian nursery rhyme. And it turns out that two bars of the notes, you can make the distinction yourself. Two bars of the flute solo in Down Under were seen as being similar to the tune of the Kookaburra nursery rhyme. Now, we were talking about George Harrison and how it was totally unconscious. He had no need to rip off the Chiffons. It was just an unconscious thing. They're both in the music world. So that wasn't a terrible misunderstanding by all concerned. But in this case, we're looking at copyright claims in music in terms of greed and in terms of sheer opportunistic greed, because the day after that TV quiz show where they alleged that two notes of the Men at Work hit song were similar to an old Australian nursery rhyme. The people who held the copyright to the old Australian nursery rhyme Kookaburra initiated legal action looking for 50% of royalties from Men at Work, which would have been millions, because the song made about 8-10 million. And the court case was bitter and horrible. And the guy, the man who wrote, the Men at Work lead singer who wrote Down Under, Colin Hay, said that the flute player of the band fell into a depression which led to his early tragic death over the court case, because the flute player felt that all he's going to be remembered for now is for allegedly stealing a flute solo from an old Australian nursery rhyme. And he wouldn't be seen as the flute player who played on one of the most famous Australian songs of all time. It was a dreadful case. The second death associated with that was, again, the lead singer, Colin Hay. His father was adamant that he should fight this court case and not give the copyright holders of the nursery rhyme 50% of the royalties. He should go to court, stand his ground, and hopefully get it thrown out of court. He died also, and Colin Hay says that his father died as a result of the stresses of the trial. The judge ultimately found that, yes, the two notes in the flute solo were taken from the Kookaburra nursery rhyme, but the band only had to pay 5% of royalties to the copyright holder of Kookaburra.
And the track itself wasn't an Australian thing at all. It was an old Welsh thing from hundreds of years before that again.
It turned out again, as you were saying about Chris Martin and Kraftwerk and who owns what, Kookaburra, the song, was in fact taken from an old Welsh folk song from 1890 or whatever. But because that wasn't in copyright, that was ineligible in court. It all gets very legal and gets very messy. But in terms of looking at a greedy, opportunistic attempt to almost, here, like you could say, extort money out of a band.
I'll give you a little blast of the track you're talking about, Down Under. Two bars of the flute solo. Okay, I wanted to talk to you about a bunch of others, but we don't have an awful lot of time. Can we just go straight to White or Shade of Pale, and what's the story there, Brian?
So we're talking about, you know, George Harrison. It was just a coincidence. We're talking about Men at Work. That was just an opportunistic, greedy grab. And also the third category, really, of famous music copyright cases is when an historical wrong has been righted. White or Shade of Pale, everyone knows that song by Procol Harum. It was released in 1967. There's a very famous sort of organ intro to it. The keyboard player always said that he wrote that. The band said, no, you didn't, no, you didn't. Song made millions. He made little to no money from the song. 40 years later, 40 years after from its release in 1967, a High Court judge in London eventually said that, yes, the keyboard player did write that intro, and therefore he was entitled to millions and millions of pounds in royalties.
And did he get them, yeah?
He got them, yeah.
Right,
and,
okay.
And it just shows, but it can take that long, Dave. It can take that long for musicologists, for lawyers, for everyone, for people. People are being asked to remember what they were doing in a rehearsal room in Twickenham in 1967 on February the 15th. But it can work out. And closer to home, there's a very famous case here.
But just before you get into that, I just want to let people hear this. Hold on. So 40 years later, he got loads of dosh. What are you saying about the Rats there?
There's a very similar story with the Boomtown Rats. You know, they had a massive global hit, What I Don't Like Mondays, which was released in 1979. And Bob Geldof always claimed that he wrote the song on his acoustic guitar in a hotel room in the US after hearing a news story about a 16-year-old girl in Georgia who had shot and killed two people at her school. And the reason she gave for her shooting spree was, I don't like Mondays. Mm. Now, the song went on to be, it's still the Boomtown Rats' most famous song. However, over the years, the band's pianist, keyboard player Johnny Fingers, real name John Moylett, always claimed that he actually wrote the song. He wrote the song, And that Bob Geldof persuaded him out of taking a credit for it and just said, no, no, just leave it as the song credited to Bob Geldof. So that's the way we always work things in this band. It only went to court 3 years ago. It was a nasty and bitter court case, but it was settled out. It was settled out of court. Now we don't know what went on because it was a private out of court settlement. But if you look up the song now, you will see that for 40 years, "I Don't Like Mondays" has been credited to songwriter Bob Geldof. It is now credited to songwriters Bob Geldof.
So maybe I'd say all wells that ends well, but maybe it hasn't been for everybody. Listen, Brian, we got to go. Journalist Brian Boyd, thanks a million, Brian, for talking to us on the programme.
Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.